Thank you so much for coming today. My name is Harry Mount, editor of the greatest magazine in the solar system, The Oldie. And I'm so sorry that some of you might have been delayed today by Mr. Trump's visit to London. Now, President Trump can try to close down London, but he will never close down the Oldie lunch. And there is a special treat for you today. You should find these slips of paper offering an exclusive offer to all of you here today at lunch to buy the perfect Christmas present, an incredibly cheap subscription to the Oldie, but the closing date is December the 13th. Now we've got three dazzling speakers today. We've also got the best MC in the business. He's worked with everyone from Max Miller to the two Ronnies, and he is in fact on the cover of the Oldie Christmas issue because among his many talents, he wrote three Morecambe and Wise Christmas specials. He is the one, the only, Mr. Barry Cryer.
Thank you, Harry. Welcome all. I've been asked to announce, actually, after the you've had your lunch and our authors and the book signing and everything, there will be a Brexit debate. This will last for 18 hours. And please inform your families if you're staying on for it. Right. We have a ritual at convention, the regulars here will know, before I introduce our authors, the parrot joke. And as I always say, if you're tempted to join in, please don't. It spoils it for the few who haven't heard it. Woman walked into a shop and saw a beautiful blue and gold parrot, and she said to the man, "He's gorgeous, how much?" He said, £20, £20. She said, £20? He's beautiful. He said, "Well, I've got to give you, he has form, he has history. He was in a brothel. And to put it delicately, he's got quite an extensive vocabulary." She thought, £20, I'll take a chance on that. Took it back to her flat and took the cover off. And the parrot looked round and said, "New place, very nice." And her two daughters walked in and the parrot said, "New place, new girls, very nice indeed." And her husband walked in and the parrot said, "Hello, Keith." Now, to business. Our next author's novel hails resistance as she views from an admiring distance the life of a Greek resistance fighter in Those Who Are Loved. Our writer tells the story of... Enough. Your host now ceases his lop-sided poem and introduces Victoria Hislop.
Somehow I never thought I'd have such an introduction from Barry. Thank you. And lovely to be at an Oldie lunch again. I think this is my third and great to be returning. Unlike Philip's character, Louis, my main character in Those Who Are Loved is not a bon viveur. She's a woman who grows up in a period of immense austerity. So just for a few minutes, in spite of the sweetness of the pudding that we've all eaten and the richness of our lunch, I'm just going to talk a little bit at the beginning about the very hard times which are the backdrop to this novel of mine, which is the 20th century in Greece from 1926, when my character Themis is born. I'm sure everyone in the room goes on to Greece on their holidays and is familiar with the azure seas and the beautiful temples and the blue and white Czech tablecloths, the tavernas. But the early part of the 20th century had no such luxuries. I suppose the sea was always as blue but the circumstances were often very tough. And I suppose that's what I generally write about. It's the slightly lesser known and tougher side of the Greek story. So I just thought I'd canter through, almost decade by decade, very quickly, the events of the 20th century, and really to set the backdrop, not just for Themis' life, who's my completely fictional woman, but for, in a way, the almost decade by decade catastrophes that afflicted that country that we all love so much. So when Themis is born in 1926, the country is still struggling to deal with a recent influx of 1 million refugees, and that was 1 million people, mostly with nothing, who came into Greece from Turkey after the war between Greece and Turkey, which ended very badly with this expulsion of the Greek population from Turkey. So when I say 1 million, in mathematical terms, that was as if Greece had had another 25% additional population, and these were people with nothing. Then in 1936, because of that imbalance economically and politically that was really created by that refugee influx, industrial unrest led to the imposition of a fascist dictatorship. So suddenly there was a new political climate in Greece. Then only 5 years later, the Nazis invaded and devastated Greece, took everything of any value outside the country, and led almost directly to a famine the following year in which hundreds of thousands of people died in the streets of Athens. Then in 1944, when the Nazis left, that was almost immediately followed by a battle in the streets of Athens. We won't go into Churchill's direct involvement because it always creates a bit of an uproar in a room, but he sent British troops basically to annihilate the communist guerrillas who'd returned to Athens after the occupation. So very soon after that, a civil war, which basically devastated anything in Greece that hadn't already been destroyed. And for 3 years, that war raged and divided the country. Then when that finished, the persecution of hundreds of thousands of people who'd fought on the left. And then into the 60s, we had the beginning of the colonel's dictatorship, which we all know as the junta, and probably a period during which perhaps many of us might have gone to Greece for the first time. And that ended about 7 years later, but only after another period of violence. We're hoping that Giles will be cheering us up soon. I've almost finished with the terrible events of Greek history, but they're important for me to tell you before I talk very briefly about my own story and why I think you might relate to it today. So the 1980s, if there's one event that took place in the 1980s, it was a huge bonfire, which you may think was a bad thing, but it was actually the first moment of 20th century Greek history that I really celebrate. And that was when they burnt many, many millions, up to 17 million files that had been kept on Greek leftists for many decades. Anyone who was considered to be subversive had a file kept on them by the government. And a decision was made in a sort of process of peace and reconciliation to destroy all of those files and, in a sense, to try and open a new chapter for the country. Then in 1990s, at the end of that decade, there was a devastating earthquake. So I'm not saying poor Greece, although perhaps beneath the surface, I'm always asking for readers and people I talk to have some kind of sympathy for where Greece is in the modern times, that they've had to endure so much in the previous 50 or 60 years. So my novel, which is about Themis, a completely imaginary character who at one part of the story fights for the communists during the Civil War. And the book opens when it's her 90th birthday. And she has around her in her small flat in Athens all her children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. And she realizes for the very first time that perhaps, you know, she's still very fit and healthy, but she realizes that she actually has nothing of any material value to leave to her children, but she does have something even more important than that, and that is her own story, what she's learned during her life. And she decides to share that with two of her grandchildren, and they're the two that have kindly stayed behind after her birthday party to help clear up all the crumbs. So I was just going to read you just a page where she makes this decision. The sun had gone down and street lamps were coming on. Themis leant across to touch her granddaughter Poppy's hand. "Why don't we go out for coffee?" she whispered. "Then we'll go into the little church. There's something I always do on my birthday." "Pray?" Poppy said with surprise, knowing that her grandmother was not specially devout. "No, Agapimu. I light some candles." "Didn't you have enough on your cake?" teased Poppy, and Themis smiled. "Who are the candles for?" Nikos asked. "Come with me and I'll tell you," she said, looking at the young man, as ever mildly thrown by the strong resemblance to her son after whom he'd been named. During the course of that day, with her family crammed into the small apartment, Themis had reflected with some regret that she had nothing to bequeath her children and grandchildren. There was little of any worth except the battered table round which the family had been eating for generations. Or was there perhaps some other kind of legacy? She suddenly realized, now that her husband Yorgos was absent in all but body, that there were things she would like to tell them. Her life story was not an heirloom, but it was all she had, and she would give it to these two young people. She loved all of her grandchildren equally, but had special affection for Poppy because she had seen her almost every day since she was born, and for Nikos, a particular soft spot, even though he only came once a year from America. They quickly got ready to leave, Nikos helping his grandmother into her cardigan, while Poppy threw on her faded red thrift shop coat. Nikos would be getting a plane back to the US the following morning, and Themis insisted he have some fresh baklava and proper Greek coffee before he left. They had all eaten copiously at lunchtime, but he could not refuse, and soon they were at the local Zacharoplastio. Once they were seated, Themis began to talk. So the rest of the novel is her story. And when I was writing this book, it occurred to me that I was, in a way, enacting something that I felt perhaps I should do in my own life, and certainly my children, and that is to talk to the generation above us. The children, just as my children do, they see their grandmother as a sort of white-haired elderly lady. They don't picture her as somebody who was ever a child or a woman in her 30s or 40s. They just see her as a sort of Mary Berry figure, I think. So, which is a great compliment. My mother is not quite as good a cook as Mary Berry. So what I've encouraged my children to do, and what I've begun to do myself, is to actually sit down with my mother and find out, you know, what was life like, you know, pre-television. I can just about remember when we had two channels, but my children certainly have no idea what it was like, you know, just to sit down of an evening, maybe in an unheated house, you know, not to be able to go out and order a latte or to smash an avocado on wholemeal toast. You know, life was so different. And we should tell our children, grandchildren, what our schoolrooms looked like, what we did after school, how we filled our time. And one key thing, which I know I had never asked my mother before, and my suggestion is that all grandparents here give to their grandchildren this Christmas a notebook and a pen or pencil, whatever is the choice, and give those children a notebook and get them to interview you, because it's not something they will have thought of, probably. And what a waste that we all have these histories inside us and most of us never get round to imparting them. Either we feel that the younger generation won't be interested. And I think that's absolutely the opposite of what is the truth. So give them all a notebook, sit down for a few hours, even if it's on Boxing Day. There'll be some terrible film that we've all seen 28 times. You might be wanting to sit down and read your oldie Christmas edition, but, you know, be patient. And essentially, as Themis, my character, who appears to her grandchildren to be such an ordinary woman, and indeed she's hidden her extraordinary history for very specific reasons, but most of us don't think our children will be interested, but I firmly believe it's absolutely the opposite, and we should all reenact some version of who do you think you are for our grandchildren, and I think they'll be, if I dare say it, quite grateful to us. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Victoria. Somebody said to me earlier, what was the other parrot joke you told last time? Do it again. So I'll make this quick. Yes, this is a request. A man said to his mate, my parrot's driving me mad, swearing all the time, drives me mad. Well, I don't know what to do about it. His mate said, stick him in the fridge for 5 minutes. So the man said to his parrot, are you going to stop swearing? And the parrot said, why don't you? So he got hold of the parrot, stuck it in the fridge and timed it on 5 minutes, and then he took it out. And he said, are you going to stop swearing? And the parrot said, all right. And the parrot looked back in the fridge and said, what did that chicken do? Now, moving rapidly on. Oh, an applause.